This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication.
In our last hour, we were discussing many aspects of my fantasy presidential campaign. So far, it has been great fun, imagining that anything could really happen beneficially in this country in regards to my own subjective contribution. But meanwhile, Rod Tyler, who has listened carefully and is always on the alert, has asked to interview me about more generic elements of my campaign, let's say my overall point of view. Okay, Rod, go for it.
What is the purpose of government?
Well, I think that the purpose of government is to be able to organize effectively various components of a society in order to further the benefit for the people who are in that situation. Of course, government in the abstract can be for just the leadership or just a certain class. But basically, it's a matter of organizing things that can't really be done effectively by people working alone.
Can the United States of America be considered a democracy?
I think it theoretically could be considered a democracy, but not a direct democracy, a representative government or a republic. But I say that theoretical because the United States at this particular point in history has representatives that basically are not listening to the people, nor are the people very much involved in the election process since they don't vote in what we call the primaries.
How would you fix the system in regards to getting the proper system that actually allows people to be represented in government?
I think that the only way that could happen, Rod, is through a grassroots movement, probably fostered electronically so people could communicate with each other rather quickly, not in the old style telephone rooms and in-person meetings, but collectively, so that they could work on developing campaigns for the primaries and for the actual elections, and also to create initiatives where a bulk of them could go forth to the various elected officials and perhaps make a difference or go to the government agencies and make their proposals. The only way to change things is to educate people and give them a voice and get them to be interactive and realize they actually have the power that was meant for them with the development of this political culture we have in the United States through the founding fathers.
What is your position on socialism?
Well, I think that socialism is a natural component of government, just like capitalism is. In other words, the control of certain areas of society by the government can be beneficial to people. But private enterprise allows people to act in such a way that they can achieve prosperity and a certain amount of happiness and freedom. So you don't really want to do away with certain types of socialism. For instance, in our country, there's Medicare, and then Social Security, the police and let's say the armed forces. These are areas completely under the control of government. You have certain benefits from the for veterans. You've got certain things like infrastructure, like roads and various type of buildings that are handled by government. Government employs people. Government can actually be helpful in things like education or healthcare. It really depends. So socialism is, to me, is not a form of government, but a component of most governments. But sometimes when it becomes too socialist or too capitalist, you have a disharmony of this type of function, and you have you move towards some kind of a dictatorship, either the dictatorship of oligarchs or dictatorship of a military type of elite or a special class of people.
So where do you draw the line between socialism or collectivism and private enterprise?
Well, I personally look at the idea of inalienable rights, and I think government must protect those rights. And so certain kinds of institutions really need to be governmental institutions so they are not corrupted by the factor of greed that sometimes enters into capitalist scenarios. You want to protect certain areas of political life. One of those, in my opinion, is health. I believe that health is an inalienable right and the government should protect people. But again, this is only possible in a non-distorted political and economic structure. And so obviously, I do think that things like Medicare and Social Security are beneficial to people. But I also think that certain things in terms of the development of people's character, I mean, I can see certain kinds of public programs that might be helpful to people, like the Peace Corps, like the Job Corps used to be in the old days. So I think the idea is you want to have the most liberty that you can without corruption and protecting the people so they can pursue the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
But how do you achieve that? How do you get rid of corruption in government?
Well, I think this is very difficult because what you first need is a citizenry that's informed, but also enlightened. In other words, not just enlightened spiritually, but enlightened ethically. You have to have enough people in the political mainstream who have enough power to enforce ethical and correct political principles where the goal is the common good. I don't think the common good is served by a pure socialist state or by a pure capitalist state. And what we're tending to in the United States is controlled by a corporate elite that even controls media and the electioneering process and just about everything having to do with gaining control over the political processes.
How do you get those wealthy, influential groups out of politics?
You can't get them out of politics. You're not really trying to get them out of politics. You're trying to get them out of a corrupted, overly... You're trying to get them out of a position of power that they don't deserve, because they don't deserve to be in a position of power just because they have money. So one of the things that you could do is create a prohibition on private capital being inserted into the political process for campaigning. You develop a public type of process for campaigning that's funded by the government. That's one way. And I would say that's probably the best way, because you need to get corruption out of government. In this particular case in the United States, that's necessary, but you can't do that unless there's a very strong electorate that really insists on it. So obviously, everything that you do has to be to develop an informed and what I would say an enlightened citizenry.
So how would you describe the way that government works right now in terms of allowing lobbyists to define the agenda of the government and basically allowing them to write our laws?
Well, the only reason that is happening is because of the funding that exists for lobbyists. You need lobbyists. You need people who are speaking for groups and organizations and companies to be able to address government. But you don't want to give them an unequal position to get in front of the elected officials. You want it to be some kind of more equal process, and you certainly don't want the elected officials to be controlled by their money through campaign funding. So lobbying itself isn't a bad idea if you can figure out a fair way of doing it. But and they do write laws, like you say, and these laws get passed. Why? Because these people their companies have bought and sold the elected officials. So we have a totally corrupt system right now. Here's a beautiful song, Believe, performed by Zave Nathan. He wrote it with his wife, Bonnie Blazak, a brilliant lyricist.
And we mustn't forsake and forget who we are, as our future and past are written in the stars. Every day of our lives we should pray to the sky. We are one, we all love, you and I.
Believe. Two words of our planet Earth, for all that it is and for all that it's worth. Our mission is clear and it is human's fate to take back the keys to the gate. We're living again through the great fall of Rome, and we really don't know if we ever get home. It's a long road ahead, but I know where to start. Stay strong and keep loving our hearts. And we mustn't forsake or forget who we are, as our future and past are written in the stars. Every day of our life we should pray sky. We are one, we are love, you and I. Believe. When we finally unite and live here in peace, then the greed and the wars and corruption will cease. But we will see much loss, and for that we will grieve. In the end it is love we'll receive. And we mustn't forsake, forget who we are, as our future and past are written in the stars. Every day of our life we should pray to the sky. We are one, we are love.
Boots in Manhattan is a coming-of-age novel by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. It is about a young Tom Boots Raymond who grows up in New York in the 1940s, who was a member of a street gang.
My friends and I were about to start our own game of stickball when Rabbit Lacey, the head of the Rattlers, came up to us and tried to move in on our game. We were called dwarves, the youngest members of this stupid gang.
Hey, Kevin, I need you to get some gloves and some stuff I left at my place.
No, this is our game.
Hey, are you my good little dwarf or what?
You've been calling me a dwarf since I was 6. We're not your personal slaves, pal.
Hey, what is this? A dwarf rebellion? All right, big guy. We ditched the dwarf thing. We make you guys regular rattlers.
No, it's too late.
He looked at Jay and me. We looked away. Rabbit was now angry, and he pushed Kevin hard with the palms of his hand. Kevin tried to ram him in the stomach, but he stepped aside, throwing Kevin into the curb where he fell to the ground, bleeding profusely at the knee. Still, he managed to get up.
My street.
Kevin shouted at Rabbit, pointing at him with an angry index finger.
Find out more by Googling Boots in Manhattan, a 1940s coming-of-age novel, part one of the novel series The Foot Soldier by Ray Boylan and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle. That's Boots in Manhattan, Ray Johnny Kindle.
Nowadays, if you are a serious business person, just getting assistance from someone with a license and a bit of experience may not be sufficient. In fact, your realtor actually needs to be knowledgeable enough to be one of your top advisors. Whether you are facilitating a giant merger or selling your company, there's a lot at stake besides your finances. There is the future value of your current investment, financial freedom, integrity, and overall reputation. If you need this kind of assistance, Sandra LaFlamme is a real estate expert with the experience, reputation, and knowledge qualified to assist you in all your key transactions. Sandra LaFlamme, real estate services with integrity and conscience. Contact her today at 888-366-8070. That's Sandra LaFlamme at 888-366-8070.
Okay, Rod, we've dealt with some general points about my campaign, view of government. Any specifics?
What's your opinion on the Patriot Act?
Well, I haven't read the Patriot Act, which I believe is over 1,000 pages. But from what I gather, it is basically a way of taking practically all of our rights in regards to protecting ourselves from government overlording the individual, taking away a lot of the rights in the Bill of Rights about the right to a speedy trial, the right to an attorney, the right of habeas corpus, the right to not be investigated or searched without a warrant. So what you have is a very strongly created police type of legal situation that deprives people of everything that we've been promised by the Constitution.
How would you solve the problem of the national debt?
That's a real big problem, because not only is our country involved in gigantic amount of printing money, but it's also involved with borrowing money, but other governments are as well. What they call quantitative easing is like an epidemic. Japan's doing it, England's doing it, other countries in Europe are doing it, China's doing it. Let's all dive in and create money. When you do that, you're creating the grounds for inflation. Now, inflation hasn't really super hit now because you can control some of that, and the mechanics of that are complex. But that has to stop. I would say that this debt, as difficult as it is, would have to be negotiated to a large extent without money. I would be in favor. The United States has been held back from succeeding commercially and for the sake of its people in terms of wages and jobs. But that doesn't mean we don't have the technology and the innovative genius to help other countries if we could be free within ourselves. So I would say that the one way that the debt could be negotiated is by providing some kind of a program of very advanced technology and administrative assistance to different countries to help them grow their economies in the proper way through technology and through business assistance. So I would be for some kind of a executive business corps that would more or less try to create the conditions for real economic growth in these countries so that we could use that as a form of barter to reduce the debt. That's one part of it.
In view of the staggering amounts of piling debt of the United States, the national debt, what would you do with the diverse programs of foreign aid that the United States has in place right now?
Well, I believe, having read a book recently about one of the people running for president right now, I won't go into the details of it, there's so much corruption. There's so much corruption in foreign aid and the reasons for giving foreign aid. I would have to review everything. But we want to cut out waste in government. We don't want to give foreign aid to a country where the foreign aid gets filtered to a small number of people. So you have a lot of corruption in foreign aid. I believe in foreign aid in this way. I do believe in tariffs. I do believe in protecting our industry. On the other hand, if you're going to protect your industry, I think you also have an obligation to help countries that are slower in economic development, that need help. Again, we're talking about that executive business peace corps, so to speak, as an example of the kind of aid that they could use. Is in addition to cash, in addition to money to help them. So it all has to be completely redone. You have to eliminate corruption from the body part of politic to do it, and then you have to be extremely careful and careful vetting of any money that actually goes to another country. I think that a lot of the foreign aid that we give is for the wrong reasons. It's for political, military, industrial reasons, and it's not for the reasons for actually helping the American people or helping other countries.
The Monroe Doctrine promised that the United States would never undertake to meddle in the domestic affairs of other countries.
Well, I guess that one didn't work.
So if you were president, would you follow a policy of interventionism, or would you respect the sovereignty of foreign nations?
I think the sovereignty of foreign nations should be respected. I think that interventionism, I mean, assuming that we could have a type of world federation like the United Nations that wasn't prejudicial in the way that it is now towards certain nations and certain powers, I would say that if there is a flagrant violation of human rights, certain types of rights, then I think that intervention is warranted. If you have some people in, like the Congo has had certain problems where you're having masses of people being killed, that is the grounds for a military intervention. And I mean, I think that this has to be examined very carefully. What are the grounds for a military intervention? But I think one of them is massive violation of human rights. I don't think that you should have the right to go into a country and change its form of government because it's not, say, a republic like the United States. But I do think that there should be a world federalist law that if a person doesn't agree with the form of government that they're under, like a monarchy or some kind of a military junta, that they have the right to leave. Here's a song from Patricia Welch's new 3-CD set featuring her beautiful renditions of top hits from the 1950s to the 1990s. Here's a wonderful homage to those who stand behind those whose quests put them before the public and support them unnoticed on their gallant journey. We need a whole lot more support for any new emerging leaders for this body politic who actually care about our country. If they dare to move forward, they will need a lot of wind beneath their wings.
It must have been cold there in my shadow to never have sunlight on your face. You were content to let me shine, that's your way. You always walked a step behind. So I was the one with all the glory, while you were the one with all the strength. A beautiful face without a name for so long, a beautiful smile to hide the pain. You ever know you are the wind. Yes, you are the wind beneath my wings. It might have appeared to go unnoticed, but I've got it all here in my heart. I want you to know, I know the truth, of course I know. I would be nothing without you. Did you ever know that you're my hero? And everything I would like to be. And I can fly higher than an eagle, 'cause you are the wind. Yes, you are the wind beneath my wings.
This is Johnny Blue Star. I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welch for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens, a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for Great Entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and dessert with Patricia Welch. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, dinner, and dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD. You won't be disappointed.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We could take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
By God, are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects, like book covers, logos, web design elements, with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com. For artist, illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
We're back. Naturally, part of my fantasy presidential campaign needs to deal with war and peace. And I have to tell you, I'm very concerned about how we slip into so many wars without a formal declaration of war. In my campaign, although I'm not ready to be super specific, I will opt for a check on the executive branch's ability to move into any type of robust military engagement without congressional approval. Naturally, there are times when circumstances demand immediate executive action, but I do not believe that engagements like Korea, Vietnam, the two wars with Iraq, or the war with Afghanistan fit into these categories. The Congress of the United States has led the collapse into an imperial presidency, and this has not been a good idea. Accordingly, in this segment, we are going to go into some of the details of our Constitution that underlie our efforts in regards to entering into war. Well, right now we're going to discuss Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the United States Constitution, which says the Congress shall have power to declare war, to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water. It's a very key phrase, and it has resulted in a lot of controversy, and perhaps to certain people feel it's some abuse of the original intent of the Founding Fathers. Could you go into a little bit, Ken, on some of this controversy?
Well, the controversy is constitutionally, I mean, legally, the Congress is the only entity out of the three branches that can declare a war. And basically now it's done by executive fiat whenever the president wants to. How they do it is they just don't call it a war. They call it a conflict. So, you know, how it's supposed to work is there's supposed to be debate and there's supposed to be discussion. And the Congress is supposed to, just like they do anything else, come to a decision whether or not we're going to have a war. And this is the idea we talked about, representative government. The Congress doesn't just pop out with this declaration of war just by accident. They have to consider what their constituents think about these issues, which means that the people are the ones who really have the right to determine whether or not we're going to go into war, which is how it should be. But now what we've got is the president will decide, president and his cabinet decide, well, we want to have a war, and we'll go to the Congress and ask for authorization. And sometimes being the commander in chief, he's even got the ships steaming over to where he wants to have the war with the nuclear warheads mounted on the missiles. And, you know, we're all ready to go. It's not an idea of how it's supposed to be.
Well, I would like to quote from an article by Michael Bolden. He is the founder of the 10th Amendment Center, but right now we're talking about this particular area of the Declaration. And he says, war was something that was a big part of the founders' distrust of power. James Madison warned us that the power of declaring war must be kept away from the executive branch when he wrote to Thomas Jefferson, and this is from Madison, the Constitution supposes what the history of all government demonstrates, that the executive is the branch of power most interested in war and most prone to it, and has accordingly, with studied care, vested the question of war in the legislature. Now, in the same article, Bolden quotes Vice President Joe Biden in 2007, not too long ago. The founding fathers were, as in most things, profoundly right. That's why I want to be very clear. If the president takes us to war without congressional approval, I will call for his impeachment. The Constitution is clear, and so am I. And I think it was very, very, very clear himself. He also, Vice President Biden, also quotes Senator Obama in the same year, 2007. The president does not have power under the Constitution to unilaterally authorize a military attack in a situation that does not invoke stopping an actual or imminent threat to the nation. That was Senator Barack Obama. Interesting, right?
Yes.
I want to kind of challenge you to guess who wrote the following. This is an argument. The Constitution distinguishes between declaring war and engaging in, quote, war, levying war. Moreover, there is no express requirement of legislative consent in other sections of the Constitution or in earlier documents before the president may commence hostilities. Accordingly, much of the debate over the power to initiate hostilities focuses on understanding the meaning of the words declare war. Supporters of presidential authority contend that the founders were well aware of the long British practice of undeclared wars. They assert that the Constitution likewise does not require formal war declarations for the president to authorize hostilities as a matter of domestic constitutional power. Who wrote that?
I'm supposed to guess?
Yes.
It's actually too intelligently formulated to have come from the lips of George W. Bush.
But it is an ally of George W. Bush.
Then it has to be either Rumsfeld or Cheney.
No, I think you must admit that it is a kind of very subtle legalese type of argument.
Well, yeah, and since the Korean War, we've been taken to all of our wars without a declaration of war from
well,
Congress.
Well, the writer of this is let me give you another guess.
Okay.
I believe he's a professor of law at the University of Berkeley.
Oh, that's not a very good guess.
It's not that close enough? Okay,
no.
Let's try John Yoo.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah.
Where he argues for the case of what has been called the imperial presidency.
Yeah, and you know, like I said before, in one of our discussions, I think it was when we were talking about my book, A Patriot's Act, one of the former advisors in the Department of Justice who was called upon to write these torture amendments was John Bybee, who's now been appointed to the Ninth Circuit Court to sit there. So, yeah, the Bush administration had people who were ready to, very intelligent people, very smart lawyers who were ready to look wherever they needed to look to justify legally whatever they wanted to do.
So we have a situation where we have had, since World War II, all these wars, all these people killed, some of them, like the Vietnam War, extraordinarily controversial.
Well, yeah, I think they've all been controversial. I mean, both Iraq wars were controversial.
But one thing about the Iraq wars is that they were fast.
They were fast, but they're still going on.
Oh, well, yes, but I'm saying the initial attack was fast. It was like, boom, boom, it's over with. We won! Yay!
Yeah.
And then again, they
mission
didn't
accomplished.
Exactly. Mission accomplished.
Yeah.
And lots of pictures, lots of publicity, and it goes on.
Except the pictures that we saw here in Europe, like I said before, you know, the bloody pictures, they don't show those in the States.
Yeah.
So I think this, the War Powers Clause and the whole, everything in the Constitution is not really subject to debate. This thing was written over 200 years ago like I said before, an owner's manual for the United States of America. And it's something you can't screw with. And that's all they've been doing, Johnny. I mean, the Congress hasn't declared war in 70 years, like you said. It's true.
Yeah, it's a lot of time.
It's not only something that the executive has taken advantage of, it's also a responsibility the Congress has shirked. This is their responsibility because we have this idea of checks and balances that each branch of government, executive, legislative, and judiciary is supposed to be separate, and they're supposed to act as a check and balance against each other. So we don't have one becoming more powerful than the other. Congress has a responsibility to keep this power to itself and not dictate it or lend it over to the executive.
Well,
that's a no-no.
The thing is, there's an economic power that doesn't recognize the difference between the campaigns for an executive position or a congressional position, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. You're getting to the root of the problem there, Johnny.
So what we have here is, the way I see it, it's almost as though the Congress basically ignores what it has to do and can listen to the presidency, because they're both harmonizing their footsteps to the same drummer, so to speak.
Well, they are, and a good example is the Patriot Act. I don't think, maybe Rand Paul read it, maybe, probably, but I don't think hardly any members of Congress read the Patriot Act before they enacted it. It went in a few days after, basically after September 11th. And I mean, these things are long and it takes a while to analyze, especially for lawyers, because other lawyers write them, right?
Yeah, sure.
But this thing, the Patriot Act, was written up long before September 11th. And it just gave them an excuse to throw it out there to basically cut off our rights. To dilute the Bill of Rights, especially the Fourth Amendment, Fourth, the Sixth, the Seventh, the Eighth, and it went in too fast. Like you're saying, we go to war too fast, right? Well, we do everything too fast because everyone's not doing.
We bail out huge countries, companies with billions of dollars too fast.
How about huge banks?
Huge banks, excuse me.
We loan them interest-free money too fast. Yeah, I mean,
we may be loaning these things too fast or approving these bills too fast, but my sensibility is that the planning is not very fast. These things are planned a long time ahead. Some of these wars, like the war with Iraq, is planned considerably ahead of time.
What I told you before in one of our discussions is that the Iraq war plan had been on Wolfowitz's desk for a long, long time. Even when Wolfowitz was serving under George the Father, and George the Father didn't want him or any of those guys anywhere near his office. He called them the crazies, and he told his staff to keep them away. But Wolfowitz basically said, "Oh, wow, now we have an opportunity," and he blew the dust off the Iraq war plan and ran it into the president, who has no clue what's going on, and basically did whatever anyone else around him told him to, because he thought these are the smart people. I got to do what they say.
Really amazing. Well, we'll be right back in a few minutes. Thanks.
The following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here! There's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charge again with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped two hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
I've worked with Russian composer Edgar Aaron for quite a few years, building an inventory of songs, many of which feature singer-performer Patricia Welch. We will soon be releasing these songs, components of an album and a musical in progress called Hadley's Castle. When Edgar and I first got together, I was amazed by the brilliance of his musical scores created for movies, TVs, and animations. Here is a sample of the work he did on the Russian TV series, available now on Amazon, called The Secret Agent's Memoir, which had 2 seasons. This score is called Escape and was created for the first season. I am very pleased to say that Bridge of Light Productions, a division of New Galaxy Enterprises, is proud to be the contact point for television and film companies seeking information about this amazing composer's work. If you're in the entertainment business and wish to know more, contact me at johnnybluestar@gmail.com. That's johnnybluestar@gmail.com. One thing I love working with Ken Eade is his multidimensionality. He is an attorney, a social activist, but also a novelist who's created 2 major suspense thrillers. One deals with Brent Marks, an attorney whose major field of battle is based on critical social issues and courtroom logistics. The other series features a sequence of exciting political thrillers, which began with a novel called An Involuntary Spy. In our last segment, Ken joined me in envisioning a new type of health focus in the United States, promising an escape from medical services and products that depend on pharmaceutical products that suppress symptoms often brought on by our highly compromised and highly processed food supplies. Our food that is loaded down with dangerous chemical additives, preservatives, and food dyes, antibiotic traces, animal hormones, and pesticides, with the further dangers suggested by improperly regulated and tested genetic modifications. Ken's protagonist in The Involuntary Spy begins as a well-paid genetic scientist who discovers serious hidden dangers in the plants that he's researching for a company indifferent to their potentially lethal social consequences. His efforts to expose the company's ill intent without losing his life forces him to flee to the Russian Federation, having used methodologies to research his company's lies and distortions that are customarily reserved for corporate and foreign espionage. Here is an excerpt from The Involuntary Spy when Seth Rogen, the hero, is aided by Yuri, a Russian handler, to create a disguise so that he can safely survive in the Russian Federation.
Chapter 4. Yuri helped Seth settle into the safe house in Moscow. Tomorrow night, he would take the 9-hour flight to the Far East. From the apartment, he could see the colorful and distinctive towers of St. Basil's Cathedral from his window, and the glittering gold onion domes of the Church of Annunciation in the Kremlin. This was the Kremlin he had seen so many times on television. Back then, during the Cold War, it had represented the seat of the Empire of Evil. Now, it was oddly beautiful. The American press was already doing damage control on Seth's report to Russia Today. The president called it propaganda, and said that the United States was against the manufacture of biological weapons. spokesman from the company said that Seth's report to RT should be disregarded as the words of a traitor and a thief. Because of his fleeing the country, Seth's story was discredited in every mainstream media report.
"Okay, your name now is George Amers," said Yuri, smiling, holding out documents. "Here is new passport."
"I'm Canadian?"
"Yes."
"Does that mean I have to say A all the time?"
"Seth, Russians don't care what you say. But don't talk to people. Don't talk to people. And don't go anywhere. Just to work and back home. Sounds boring. Isn't that what you guys do in America anyway?"
"Well, yeah."
"Okay. Don't make friends. If you want a girl, we get you a girl."
"That sucks."
"Look, it's only for 6 months. Then you can do what you want. If you see anything suspicious, call me."
"6 months, eh?"
"Yes, 6 months. Oh, and shave mustache and color hair."
"What?
You prefer shave head and color mustache?"
"No, no, that's okay. I'll take the hair color."
"And we fix nose."
"What's wrong with my nose?"
"Nose too big."
"It's not."
"We fix anyway."
"Okay, let me see if I've got it. Don't go anywhere, don't make friends, sleep with prostitutes that you send to me, and wear a disguise."
"Yes, you are smart. Don't forget to use lenses I gave you for eyes. And
what?
Lose some weight."
Seth worked on his disguise with the materials Yuri had left in the safe house. He said a fond farewell to the mustache that had been with him since high school, and picked a dark brown color to mask his light brown hair. With the contacts in, his eyes changed from green to brown. He didn't even recognize himself. The surface disguise was the easy part. Being George Amers would be the true disguise to master.
We go out with Orange Colored Sky, as performed by Patricia Welch on her new 46-song CD, Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia. Check it out at patriciawelch.com/CD. That's patriciawelch.com/CD.
I was walking along, minding my business, when out of an orange-colored sky, flash, bam, alakazam, wonderful you came by. I was humming a tune, drinking in sunshine, when out of that orange-colored view, flash, bam, alakazam, I've got a look at you. Yeah, one look and I yell, timber, watch out for flying glass. 'Cause the ceiling fell in and the bottom fell out, I went into a spin and I started to shout, I've been hit, this is it, this is it. I was walking along, minding my business, when love came